change of the peak-to-valley ratio between strong signals and weak signals. Let me drop for the advertisement. So, I wonder if you're doing chemical analysis, Wes. I'm going to pass it back to you for that, because many of the spectrometers of the type that I think you're talking about are used for chemical analysis, and maybe that's what you're doing also. And when I get a chance, I'm going to correct something that I was telling you guys during the mini technet that we had last Wednesday night. I suddenly realized I was making an error. I was trying very hard, but I had a belief at that time that I no longer believe in. Back to you, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW, the technet.
The logic part of N2XJN was that when I saw the Thomson experiment and the blowing circle in the glass sample, I know that I'm dealing with plasma inside, and ionic structure that is on the influence of the components of the field by which that circle is being drilled. So then I said to myself, hey, how nice would be like to analyze that. Then I got to the authors of the spectrometer, and one of them is the atomic absorption spectrometer. Basically, it's a photosampler, and this one is able to analyze the ionic structure of the gases as well. Then I went to the literature and I found out that these spectrometers sometimes are being called atomizers. So then I started to look at it and I found that electrothermal atomizers, which if we're dealing with plasma, we have a thermal factor as well. So it's heated to passage of the electricity through the body of the device. And samples might be heated by a conductive or convective or radiative process with the atomizer. And there are different kind of atomizers that could be distinguished by the method in which the current flow. And there was another thing about...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Sorry about that. Then I went to the Thomson experiment, and the Thomson was using a device similar to the cathode ray tube. And he discovered the electron and measured the ratio of its electric charge and the mass. So the Thomson experiment was concerned with the observing the deflection of the beam of the particles in the combined electric and magnetic fields. Anyhow, spectrometry does have an application in this area. And then if you look at the last image that I have sent you, you see the nice pictures of hot filament ionization gauge, which I happen to find in Wikipedia, also a lot of information about it, and that, for me, is, if you recall that video that you look at, Chemi study by, from 1943, let me jump, by Westinghouse, you've seen a glass envelope and you've seen a bombardment with the ions through the slit where there was a passage to the certain wavelength of the light, and then by that bombardment you were able to rip off the electron out of the steady structure inside. So I found interesting things that this costs pennies, $15, $70, $33, and you can have it, and there is a chance to actually play with it. And they have something like a hot filament gauge which is replaceable. So you can simply unscrew that, replace that. Very, very much inexpensive way to play with the experiment of Samsung. That's what I could say about it so far. Let me jump. The basic component of the spectrometer is that you have a light source, which is usually the lamp, could be X-ray as well. And then you have something like atomization chamber, which is usually made from graphite, and it consists in the form of graphite furnace. Then you have a monochromator, which looks like a pyramid, which is a glass structure, and will allow you to get into the single components of the light, and then it goes to it sort of diffractor. Then it goes to the detector, and then at the end of it you have a signal processor, a computer, whatever you have, and that's how it works. I believe that that's all about the subject. Back to you.
And from your discussion, I suddenly realized that there's another kind of spectrometer, which is the mass spectrometer. In other words, by putting a known magnetic field or a known charge, and knowing either the charge or the velocity of the particles that you're putting through the mass spectrometer, by measuring the amount of deflection you create, you can figure out what are the mass of the particles. When you study what's being done with the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, at CERN in France and Switzerland, there they've got some extremely elaborate detecting devices. They call them calorimeters, but in reality they're really measuring charge, mass, velocity, everything about the particles that are coming out of the collisions that they're creating in that huge machine. They're moving particles in both the clockwise direction and the counterclockwise direction, and they're moving particles at a velocity that I think is like a 8 nines followed by a 6 times the speed of light, point 8 nines and a 6, as I remember. In fact, the final velocity they're achieving is something like 16 meters per second less than the speed of light. They're putting a lot of energy in those particles, and there's been various estimates as to what happens. Let me drop.
That is a good subject. I have a comment on it.
Yeah, they've made predictions as to if all of the particles in the beam have to be dissipated in a hurry, how much energy is there and how much destruction it can do. And if you have a so-called quenching event, if these superconducting magnets, and there's 1,600 of them, some great big number, if a failure occurs in one of those, or multiple of those, the total amount of stored energy in these extremely strong superconducting field magnetic cryogenic magnets, let me drop, if all of that magnetic energy becomes quenched, it can do a tremendous amount of damage. So to charge that machine with the right amount of magnetic field, and to charge that machine with the right number of particles moving at the right speed, you've got lots of stored energy there, and you've got to be careful how you use it. As I said, when I get a chance, I want to go back and correct something that I said about electromagnetic waves last Wednesday. So there is a beautiful book that I bought on the LHC. I'll go get a copy of it later and give you the name of it. If you want to really understand the LHC, there's a not very expensive book. I think it's around $15 or $20 being sold on Amazon and eBay and whatever. That tells you what they intend to do, how they did it, some beautiful pictures. They tell you what particles they now know about in the so-called unified field theory and whatever of studying matter at the atomic level. And they got a long way to go. This universe is not simple. Everyone thinks it's going to be some kind of unified theory that all makes it very simple. So far, that's not proving to be true. Back to you, Wes, KQRIW.
Intuition. Yes, you touched the mass spectrometry, and that's a very interesting subject. and that comes to the Thompson. And he's got a ray tube, and he's discoverer of the electron. There are two basic phenomena that play a significant role in this. The existence of the magnetic field associated with the electric current and the deflection of moving charged particles in the magnetic field. So I would like to briefly touch that two phenomena. If we go to the magnetic fields and forces, the forces between electric currents are called magnetic forces because the same phenomenon accounts for the forces acting between magnetic materials such as, say, pieces of magnetized iron. I remember there was a William Gilbert and Queen Elizabeth, the physicians, yes, noted that the magnet had two poles at which magnetic effect seems to be concentrated. That's why they call it William Gilbert and Queen Elizabeth. Anyhow, it shows that like poles repel each other when unlike poles attract each other. So the forces between magnetic poles in exact analogy with the electrostatic forces between charges, they introduce the magnetic field to the field lines. And then we have a in the article that I have sent you,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
What am I doing today? If you have a conductor and keep the conductor in your hand, then you see that you that the circles around, which is the right hand rule for the magnetic flux going around. So the electric currents are intimately related to the magnetic properties of the materials, and they placed if you place the magnetic needle over the wire, you can observe that the needle movement, I don't know how to say it properly, you're going to see that the needle movement in the direction of the flux. The same mechanism we have in the solenoid and the magnet, let me jump. And then we have something that is being called a Helmholtz coil, Helmholtz coil. And basically this is the structure of two parallel coils separated by the distance that is equal to the radius of the coil. And they are being used usually because they generate a magnetic field that is uniform of the appreciable region about its midpoint. So the Helmholtz coil could be used to carry out a certain task in within the mass spectrometry. Basically, principles of how it works. But then, we're dealing with the magnetic field of the Earth. And the Earth magnetic field is the field of the magnetic dipole, which means that it is an equivalent to the external field of the huge bar magnet. And the lines of the force of such fields are directed not towards the geographic poles, but rather towards the magnetic poles. So the magnetic north pole is located near the geographic south pole. And they are also directed, except the equator, towards away from the center of the Earth. So we're dealing with kind of hypothetical magnet figure and hypothetical spectrometry of the Earth. So I found that very much fascinating. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to take these things in order. If you want to really see some very fancy particle detectors, you want to read this book, which is not very expensive. It's called The Quantum Frontier, subtitled The Large Hadron Collider, by Don Lincoln, L-I-N-C-O-L-N, John Hopkins University Press, 2009. As I said, it wasn't a very expensive book. I vaguely remember it was like $20. And it's not a super thick book. I guess it's 168 pages, not including the index. That's what I'm looking at. Reasonably well illustrated, nicely done, designed for people who are not directly in the particle accelerator business. But one of the things that's not made clear to an awful lot of people is, why do we build a particle accelerator? Well, to study matter. Well, why do we have to do it that way? Why don't we study the particles directly rather than smashing into each other? Let me drop. And the answer is, you can't make them smash into each other. You ask the average engineer, scientist, person that you meet, whatever. When a meteor comes into the Earth and you watch it burn up, what's making the heat? 99% of those people will say, well, it's friction, the air friction. It's hitting the air at a very high velocity, and the friction creates the heating. Good guess, no. There is no friction. The shock wave in front of that meteor hitting that air mass, the compression of that wave, it's the Thompson effect. No, it's not Thompson effect. I can't think of the Boyle's law, PV equals NRT. The compression of the air in front of the meteor creates the heating. The leading edge of the wing of a supersonic airplane is getting hot because the air gets compressed. Those air molecules, at room temperature, air molecules are moving 500 meters per second. They're slamming into each other at billions of times per second, and every single slam into each other is a perfect bounce. The very strong electrostatic field of the cloud of electrons around every single molecule is such a strong electrostatic field, and they're all negative on the outer cloud, and they all come close to each other. The negative-negative repulsion takes place, and they bounce apart with absolutely no loss of energy. So none of the air molecules touch each other. None of the air molecules touch the container. They don't touch the leading edge of the wing. They don't touch the meteor. The particle accelerator allows you to accelerate those particles so fast that for the first time they have enough kinetic energy to penetrate that outer cloud of electrostatic repulsion of all that electron cloud. And for the first time, one molecule goes into the vicinity, inside the vicinity of the other molecule, and it can really take them apart. So this
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now this is slightly related to what we were discussing last Wednesday night, where I talked about the solenoid coil, and you push the magnet in, and the coil is connected to a zero center milliammeter, microammeter, and as you push the magnet in, you'll see the coil, you'll see the needle deflect to the right. As you pull the magnet out, you'll see the coil, you'll see the voltmeter deflect to the left. That's a demonstration of Faraday's law. The rate of change of magnetic field inside of a circle of conducting material determines what current or what voltage will flow in that circle of conducting material. The Earth is creating a magnetic field, and the theory is that the flow of conducting surfaces, the substances, the molten core, and the flow of that material is giving us this great big almost bar magnet we get out of the Earth, and the Earth's magnetic pole does not line up with the geographic or the rotational pole. The pole of the center of rotation, the shaft of rotation of the Earth, is very different in location than the pole of magnetic north and magnetic south. Where we live right now, there's something like 12.5 degrees of magnetic deviation.
So I have a question for you. What is the general direction of the Earth magnetic field in northern hemisphere?
And there's lots of maps printed on that one. Where you and I live right now, your compass aims 12 and a half degrees to the west of the geographic north. So magnetic north is 12 and a half degrees to the west. On your, where you live on Long Island, 12 and a half degrees to the west is where your magnetic compass aims. And so you have to make 12 and a half degrees of correction clockwise if you want to know where true north is as far as geographic north. Now, that north pole of the Earth is in a place in northern Canada. If you are somewhere near the center of the Earth, the magnetic deviation goes to zero. When you're in California, the magnetic deviation goes something like 15 degrees clockwise to the east. So, depending on where you are, there's a whole bunch of maps for the United States that you can Google, which will show you a whole bunch of contour lines as to how different is magnetic north versus versus geodetic geologic north, you know, mapping north, true north. How different is magnetic north? It's a function of where is your latitude and longitude in the United States, Canada, or wherever. And that's true everywhere in the world.
I'm a little bit confused. At first, the Earth magnetic field plunge into or emerge from the Earth at the North Geographic Pole. Then, the second question should be asked.
Okay. The Earth acts like it's rotating on a shaft. And that shaft goes through the true North Pole and the true South Pole as far as our maps are concerned. That's the rotational North Pole and South Pole. Inside of the Earth, there is the equivalent of a bar magnet. The bar magnet has been twisted compared to that shaft. The twist is such that the northern end of the bar magnet is shifted a large number of miles away from the true North Pole. It's shifted toward central Canada. And on the South Pole, there's a similar shift. So the magnetic North and South Pole are shifted. The true North Pole, as far as mapping is concerned, it has some of the magnetic field going in there, but that is not the peak of the magnetic field. The center of the bar magnet of the Earth is displaced, I'm not sure the exact number, but it's probably 1,500 miles to the south towards central Canada. And that exact point of maximum magnetic north is not stationary. It slowly drifts. So the magnetic pole of the Earth is shifted quite a bit from our mapping or geological North Pole. I wonder if that helps a little bit there, Chesley. K2RIW, N2XJM, K2RIW.
Okay, talking about the aurora, what effect does the mass of an ion, which we dealing with ionosphere, so what effect does the mass of an ion moving a magnetic field have on the radius of the circular trajectory?
Okay, when it comes to the aurora and all of these other effects of the solar wind hitting our magnetic field, and where the aurora borealis happens is it tends to happen around the magnetic North Pole, not the true North Pole. I know there's a lot more to this. Joe, I know you wanted to ask something on this. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, in the second end.
Actually, I was just checking in very, very late by a couple of hours. I wanted to ask a question, but I'm not sure how deep you are into the subject you're in already.
I have just a few questions. Talking about HARP system, the artificial heating of the ionosphere, what effect does the accelerating voltage have on the radius of the circular trajectory?
When you're talking about circular trajectory, and you're probably talking about the trajectory of the solar wind particles, that they tend to move essentially parallel to the Earth's magnetic field lines. They tend to dive in near the magnetic North Pole and magnetic South Pole, and that's the major causative agent for the aurora lighting that we see, the aurora borealis. So you're now asking, the HOMP experiment, does it move those trajectories? And I think the answer is no. Those trajectories are due to a magnetic field. HOMP, to my knowledge, is having a very minor, if any, effect on the magnetic field. The HOMP experiment recognizes the fact that there are partially ionized particles in what you and I call the ionosphere. Most of those particles are happening from ultraviolet radiation coming out of the sun, hitting those upper air molecules and ionizing, gripping electrons away from those nucleuses of those air molecules. The HOMP experiment is aiming a large radio signal at them, and it creates excessive heating. It increases the heat of those ionized particles. The heating process really means their velocity. So the strong radio field from HOMP is making those air molecules that have already been ionized, it is making them move faster. When they move faster, they now have the ability to collide with other air molecules and create impact ionization, and therefore increase the amount of ionosphere in that area. That is my guess as to what the mechanism of HOMP is. And I think HOMP has almost no effect on the Earth's magnetic field. The Earth's magnetic field is a very big bar magnet, and by comparison, HOMP...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
Even though you and I consider the HOMP machine a very big and very powerful machine by our standards, compared to the standards of the Earth's size and the size of that Earth's magnetic bar magnet, I think HOMP is an extremely minor perturbation, if you know what I mean. I wonder if that's a guess on my part, Wesley. And as I'm about to tell you, some of the guesses I made last Wednesday, I want to correct. Into XJN, K2RIW.
Into XJN. Well, the whole notion about the spectrometry was because I was dealing in the Thomson experiment with the plasma. Plasma has to have a mass, and then the spectrometry, this mass spectrometry, will allow me to measure the concentration of the mass. But then, based what you're saying, is I have asked previously the question about accelerating voltage and what effect it will have on the radius of the circular trajectory. But now, I'm asking you, what effect does the charge have on the radius of the circular trajectory? And if there is any distinctive difference between those two?
To my knowledge, there's a lot of difference between the Van Allen belt and the ionosphere. I think they're separated by a long distance. I know they are. The Van Allen belt is up at numbers like 300 kilometers. The ionosphere are up numbers like 30 and 50 and 60 kilometers. So there's a big separation between the two. So we got to make sure we're not confusing ionosphere with Van Allen belt. Van Allen belt is where the solar wind particles get captured into our Earth's magnetic field, and they oscillate back and forth between the North Pole and the South Pole, and the ones that hit the atmosphere near the North Magnetic Pole are the ones that are creating what you and I call the aurora borealis, that the fast-moving particles in the Van Allen belt hitting the atmosphere create the lighting that we see that looks like the aurora curtain. It's also creating ionization, obvious by the fact that I've reflected radio signals off of that aurora borealis. It's a rather good reflecting object for certain VHF frequencies. Now, one of the things, and when it comes to mass spectrometry, the reason I'm mentioning this article, this book, The Quantum Frontier, The Large Hadron Collider, is that there they do a lot of mass spectrometry. In other words, quite a few of those, let me drop. Quite a few of those very large detectors. detecting devices that are part of the Large Hadron Collider are measuring mass spectrometry. Now, one of the things that I want to mention, I want to correct from last week, was that I was saying that when you've got two waves propagating on a transmission line in opposite directions, that two waves do not add together at the point where they hit maximum positive and maximum negative voltage. I want to correct that. They definitely do. Let me drop. I now realize that when you've got a wave, whether it be a wave in water, whether it be a wave in a TEM wave in a coaxial cable, whether it be a wave in free space, we've all heard of the so-called perfect wave. You could be sailing your sailboat somewhere in the ocean, and a wave is coming from the north and a wave is coming from the east, two separate wave phenomena, and they happen to meet, they both hit a positive peak right at your particular boat, the so-called perfect wave. And you get one of those, and it's going to be severe. You're going to get something like twice the normal wave height. By the same token, when I've got a very strong standing wave on a coaxial cable, your slotted line, if that's what you're using, is measuring the peaks and valleys. It doesn't have to touch the center conductor to do that. It's just measuring the presence of the local field. And I was saying that the wave going from east to west and the wave going from west to east only become mixed together in your probe and in your detector. When it comes to the mixing of those waves, as far as the detection is concerned, to operate your Hewlett-Packard 415 standing wave ratio meter, there's a degree of truth about that. But the real voltage on the semiconductor really does double if I have a perfect short circuit. If I have a large standing wave, if I have a 1 watt signal generator transmitting a signal through a cable going into a dummy load, and I measure the voltage that's on the cable, and I now put a direct short circuit or a direct open circuit at the end of that cable, so that all the signal becomes reflected, and I've got a pure 50 ohm signal generator, I now can find places on that cable where the voltage, what it used to be compared to what it is now, the voltage really is double. And at some other point, a quarter wave away.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
At some other point, a quarter wave away, the current really is doubled. So we've talked about sailboats that have hit the so-called perfect wave where the waves add together. We've all measured standing wave ratio where the voltages double in some particular place. We could, if you want to, build a standing wave detector that measures magnetic field, that measures current. You'll find that the current somewhere is doubled. I've also had standing wave on a cable where I'm putting a kilowatt of power through it, and I measured the hot spots on the cable. There are places every half wave on the cable where the current is drastically increased because of the standing wave ratio, and the cable becomes hotter in those areas. Well, now you've got to be careful. The particular cable you're using, is it a polyethylene cable, and you're using it at a UHF frequency, or is it air-filled foam cable? You got to worry about, is the major loss mechanism of your particular cable at your particular frequency, is it dielectric constant loss, is it loss tangent of the dielectric material, like polyethylene, there you'd get maximum heating where the voltage is maximum, or is it the current flowing through the cable creating resistive loss, and therefore the places where the current is maximum is where you're going to get the greatest heating of the cable. Let me drop. So you can definitely find places where the cable is hotter every half wavelength, depending on what kind of cable, what frequencies, and whatever. John, I heard you on the input, but I didn't hear you through the machine. Beyond 11 o'clock, the machine requires a 4Z PL, 136.5. So are you sure that your PL is turned on, John? KC2WGB, I know you got a question on this one. I'll hear you on the input regardless. K2RIW.
How about now, Dick?
I'm hearing you beautiful now. It turns like you looks like you turned on your PL tone. Go ahead, John.
Okay. I just wanted to remind you, Wednesday you did correct yourself on that subject because you explained how when they added we could get a voltage breakdown on that cable. So you did give us the correct information on that point.
I have additional question about that, because if you have a bay with the quiet water and you put the plumbs at the same time, you have a waves that are going the opposite direction, and then you see a double of the ripples on the water. So when we have a 144 megahertz, which is 2 meters band, and we have the slotted line or the coaxial cable that is cut inside, and we put the probe inside right beneath the braid on it, let me drop, with the perfect 50 ohm at the end of it, we will see three 0 points and two high peaks. That would be 0 points, I would say no, right, and two yes. Now, if we then open it up, how many ripples are we going to have? And to exit.
I'll start off with the pool of water. I drop a pebble into the north end of pool of water, and I'll watch a wave or a series of waves starting off as a circle and get wider and wider as they travel to the south. And I drop a pebble into the south end of the pool, and I'll watch the waves traveling to the north. I drop a pebble into the north end of the pool and the south end of the pool simultaneously. This could be a puddle of water on the street, so to speak. And I watch those waves fold through each other with essentially no interaction of any kind. There's a catch to that. The waves have to be small enough that where they hit each other in the center, if the combined amplitude of the wave is tall enough to give you what's called a white cap, a non-linearity of the way the water behaves, now you start getting some mixing and you get some interaction. But as long as the waves are small enough, they completely fold through each other. And one of the things that we were having great trouble with is to figure out, how does the wave starting from the south know that it's going to travel to the north and in no other direction? And how does the wave traveling from the north going to the south, how does it know it's going to the south in no other direction? At first, John said that the individual water molecules of the wave only move up and down. And if that was true, let me drop. If the individual water molecules moved only up and down, then they would have no directional characteristic. And once you get a chunk of water moving up and down, it would create a wave propagating to the north and to the south simultaneously. Well, yes, you could create an artificial wave that moves only up and down, and it will create a wave that goes to the north and to the south. But the real wave that you started by way of a pebble to the north creates a wave moving to the south, and that individual water molecules, as the wave encounters them, you study those water molecules. They are not moving purely vertical. You look at them side view, they're moving in an elliptical pattern. They move up and down and left and right, and just the right elliptical pattern. That gives the wave directionality. By the same token, the electromagnetic wave that's traveling down my coaxial cable, it has directionality. It obeys the so-called pointing vector. Let me drop. If I look at the wave versus position along the cable and I stop time, it is a sinusoidal plot. But that sinusoidal plot is really, when I turn time back on again, it's really moving at the speed of light, so to speak, the speed, the velocity factor of the cable, it's moving in one direction. If I choose the spot where the voltage is maximum of a forward-going wave on a coaxial cable, at the place where the voltage is maximum, the current is maximum, the magnetic field is maximum, the magnetic field alongside of the voltage E field, volts per meter, if I take the vector of voltage and I use it as a arrow going from the center of the clock to a 12 o'clock, I've got a vertically polarized wave at that point, and the point that I'm analyzing from the center conductor up toward the outer conductor of the cable. I'm analyzing that, and I've got a vertical going vector toward 12 o'clock of E field. and assuming that the H field at that point is a horizontal vector going from the center toward 3 o'clock. And if I take my my vector of voltage toward 12 o'clock, rotate it toward my vector of H field, magnetic field, at 3 o'clock, I'm rotating from 12 o'clock toward 3 o'clock. If I rotate in a clockwise manner, when I cross E toward H, when I keep track of the polarities, and I cross, I do a vector cross product of E into H, I'm rotating from 12 toward 3, the way a right-handed screw would advance in that rotation tells you the direction of propagation. That's the so-called pointing vector. Let me drop. So, built into the wave on a electromagnetic wave, a single electromagnetic wave traveling on a coaxial cable, it has directionality. And your next question is going to be, well, that's what you've analyzed where the voltage is positive. What happens if I move half wave down the cable where the voltage is negative? Well, where the voltage is negative, the E field is opposite, the H field is opposite in polarity. So if I keep track of polarity, I'm now starting at 6 o'clock and rotating toward 9 o'clock when I cross E into H. Again, I get the same clockwise rotation. I get the same directionality. So the single wave, whether it be a wave in water, whether it be a pulse going up my guy wire, or whether it be a electromagnetic wave going down my coaxial cable, at every point it has directionality. It is moving in one direction only, and the peak of E and the peak of H are in the exact same location, whether it be in the cable or in free space. But there's a catch. You now create strong standing wave ratio. Let me drop. You now create a wave, a big strong wave going in the opposite direction at the same time. I've got a signal generator on the east end of this cable. I've got another signal generator on the west end of the cable, and I turn them both on at the same time, and they're both at the exact same frequency. I've locked the reference oscillators, so they're in phase on the exact same frequency continuously. I've now got two waves going in opposite directions. I could have also done it with one signal generator and a short circuit on the cable. Doesn't matter. I get the same answer. But now I've got two separate waves going in two directions. And yes, there's a place on that cable where the voltage is now double. And I've got two waves, one coming from the east, one coming from the west. I'm analyzing them at that point. The voltage is doubled, but there's a catch. The wave going to the east is making a clockwise magnetic field around that semiconductor. The wave from the west is making a counterclockwise wave around that semiconductor. Those two magnetic fields, clockwise and counterclockwise, cancel. So when I've got a very strong standing wave ratio, for the first time, the E and the H's don't line up anymore. The place on the cable where I get maximum E, I have minimum H. I have minimum current. I've got a current that's trying to flow from east to west due to one of the waves. I've got a current that's trying to flow from west to east due to the other wave. And at the place where the voltage is maximum, those two current waveforms cancel. So with high standing wave ratio, for the first time, your maximum E and maximum H doesn't line up anymore. Now the place where the voltage is maximum is one particular place, and a quarter wave downrange from there, the current is maximum. So the current maximums are all half wave apart, but they displace a quarter wave from the voltage maximums.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
They displace from each other a quarter wave when there is a high standing wave ratio. You'd be amazed how many people confuse all of that, and I'm one of them last Wednesday. I think I've got it a little bit straighter now. I know you guys are going to have some more questions on this because the books do not well cover this subject, in my opinion. K2RIW listening. Wesley, anyone else?
GP also.
Okay, John also. Go ahead, Wes, and John in that order. Wes first.
Yeah, I was reading the material for my 4194A, which is the gain phase analyzer. And the gain phase analyzer has the feature that has a four leads, like a typical for the impedance analyzing. And it shows that, yes, for cancellation of the field, there is, as a matter of fact, the cancellation of the magnetic flux, because it goes in a different direction, but what it shows on the coaxial cable, that the magnetic field that is created in the center conductor goes to the right, but in the bridge goes to the left. Back to you, Andrew Sheehan.
Okay, you said in the center conductor of the coax cable, the magnetic field goes to the right. In the bridge, the magnetic field goes to the left. I don't have enough raw information to know.
I think you said braid, Dick.
Oh, in the braid. Okay, yes. The magnetic field due to the center conductor, I'm saying dominates. The magnetic field due to the outer conductor, I am guessing is secondary. Yes, without a doubt, the current flowing in the outer conductor is in the opposite direction. But now you're on the inside of that current sheath as opposed to be on the outside. When you're studying the current flowing in the center conductor, the magnetic field is outside of that sheath of current because of skin effect. When you're inside of the center outer conductor, when you're talking about the current flowing in the outer conductor, you're now inside, not outside. And that might reverse the polarity. It also has a much larger diameter. Let's start off with twin lead. In the case of twin lead, I definitely have equal current on the left-hand wire and the right-hand wire. And those currents are in the opposite direction. On the right-hand wire, the current is flowing away from me, and that's making, from my point of view, as I put my hand on the right-hand wire, and my thumb is pointing in the direction of the current, the magnetic field, due to that right-hand current, is clockwise, following my curve of my fingers. If I now take my hand away from the right-hand wire, let me drop, and put it on the left-hand wire, I have to turn my hand upside down, so to speak. My thumb is now pointing toward me instead of away from me because the current is flowing in the opposite direction on the left-hand wire. And again, from my hand's point of view, my fingers are still wrapping around the wire in a particular way. And if I now analyze the magnetic field midway between the two wires, the magnetic field creating from the right-hand curve of my fingers and the magnetic field creating from the left-hand wire curve of my fingers, those two magnetic fields add in the center. So on twin lead, before I hop from twin lead to coax cable, do you see how in twin lead, the current flowing in the left wire and the right wire both add in a co-phase manner in the center between the two wires? See if that makes some sense there, Wes. N2XJM, K2RIW.
It does. I'm looking at that diagram right now. It shows the coaxial cable. It shows the direction of the center conductor signal, which would be the electromagnetic wave. And it shows the right hand electromagnetic field on it. The only problem that I have with it is that they show the electromagnetic field much larger than the diameter of the braid. And then it is being called magnetic flux generated by the test current inside. So the test current goes through the inner cable. Now, the opposite circle of the magnetic flux, it is created or generated by the return current. And it says the return current goes through the outer shield. And I remember when we were talking about the power distribution in the electromagnetic wave. Let me jump.
I'm disagreeing with this.
This comes from the Hewlett-Packard, a guide to measurement technology and techniques, measurement technologies, and this is for impedance measurement basics.
I know for a fact that well-designed coaxial cable with well-shielded connectors going into a well-shielded signal generator, that 99.99% of all of that electromagnetic wave that you put into that coaxial cable is contained inside of the inner surface of the outer braid, that none of that signal, magnetic field, E field, H field, none of that signal gets out of that cable if it's a good cable being properly used. The reason I started off with twin lead is because if I can prove that the main current going out and the return current, that's the current flowing on the left wire and the right wire of twin lead, has a magnetic field that adds in the center. And now by the Minerva principle, I can change the impedance of any cable as long as I do it slowly in ohms per wavelength, and I can also do it in the other way. I can take the left-hand conductor of twin lead, and I can make it larger and larger. I can make very unbalanced-looking twin lead, but it still will work very well. And as I make the outer conductor, as I make the left-hand conductor of the twin lead, not only larger in diameter, that's one way I can do it, I can also start making it slowly starting to go from a round piece of wire. I can slowly expand it as I move in the Z direction. I can move it into a sheet of copper, where the sheet of copper is growing in a direction perpendicular to the length of the cable. And I can make that sheet of copper on the left-hand side slowly grow vertically, start curving, and eventually curve around the right-hand conductor. I can slowly make a piece of twin lead.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I can slowly make a piece of twin lead turn into a coaxial cable. I have personally done that. I can make a nearly perfect impedance match as long as I do it slow enough versus length. I can slowly make a piece of coax cable, a piece of twin lead turn into a coax cable or vice versa. I can take a piece of coax cable where I cut a slot along the length of the outer conductor, and as I go down the cable, the slot becomes wider and wider, and eventually the coax cable becomes twin lead. And I know I'm not disturbing the flow of the signal or the impedance of the cable. So the way the magnetic field works between coax and twin lead, there has to be a correlation between the two.
I believe we could agree with that, because I just read something that I would like you to take a stand on it. Well, they explain it first on the drawing how it works, but then they say when the device under test impedance is below 10 milliohm, large signal current flows through the current leads, generating external magnetic field around the leads. And really, it's a coaxial. The magnetic fields induce error voltages in the adjacent voltage sensing leads. The effect of mutual coupling between the current and the voltage leads is illustrated in figure, whatever. The induced error voltages in the voltage sensing leads cause a measurement error in very low impedance measurement. Back to you.
Oh, I'm going to agree with this now. If you're trying to measure 10 milliohms, or if you've got 10 milliohms of excess resistance in the way the connector is put on the end of the cable, all kinds of leakages and signals on the outside can happen, and all kinds of errors can happen. I personally try to measure with a network analyzer exactly what was happening in a circuit that had 2,000 ohms of impedance. It happened to be an RFID tag, and the little black chip in the center of an RFID tag is operating at 2,000 ohms. And I tried to make the right kind of instrumentation on a 50-ohm Rodenschwartz network analyzer so that I could make exact amplitude and phase measurements and standing wave ratio measurements at 2,000 ohms. And I rapidly discovered that, wow, you can't do that. Or I didn't have anywhere near the right instrumentation, the right adapters. Once at 2,000 ohms, which is, let me think, 50 into 2,000 is what? 40. When the impedance you're trying to measure is 40 times higher than the design impedance of the network analyzer, I think I can safely say that the errors you develop, unless you're very careful, the errors are either 40 times larger or 40 times squared larger. I'm not sure which. I was developing some huge errors, and I wasn't able to make the direct measurement. I know that John had some questions on what we've said so far on twin lead and coax cable and how the signals flow. Over to you, John. K2RIW and the TechNet.
John, don't forget to ask about the voltage doubling that you asked me for, the 4 volts and 4 volts.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think we'll have time for that tonight. But Dick, I have a question on the twin lead. I'm confused. Using the right hand rule, when you followed the right hand side, you were clockwise, and when you went to the left, it was counterclockwise. And you said it was added in the center. Wouldn't that be neutralized?
A good guess, no. Assume that at the point I'm analyzing on the twin lead, John, that the right-hand side, the current is flowing away from me, and the return current on the left-hand side has to be flowing toward me. Okay? I take my right hand, I grab the right-hand wire, my thumb points in the direction of the current curving around that wire, and you can see that my fingers are aimed upward at the center between the two wires. A friend of mine grabbed the left-hand wire. His thumb is aimed toward me. His fingers are curved around the wire correctly for the current that's flowing. His fingers are facing upward in the center between the two wires. So from a single point of view, clockwise on right-hand wire, counterclockwise from the same point of view on the left-hand wire, means that in the center of the wire, both fingers from the right-hand wire, the fingers are aimed upward. From the left-hand wire, the fingers are aimed upward. The magnetic field in the center, I say, is adding. Does that make it a little clearer, John? Go ahead.
Exactly, Dick. Okay, that's better. I had misconstrued your meaning.
So, there is a so-called Minerva principle by which I can take a piece of coax cable with an outer conductor that's made out of sheet metal. I can draw a slot down that as if I'm making a slotted line, but I make the slot a V-shaped slot where it becomes wider and wider as it moves away from me. I got the cable, I got the beginning of the cable into my chest, the rest of the cable is aimed away from me. I've started a slot on the top of the cable at the 12 o'clock position, and as I move further and further away from me, the slot gets wider and wider. And if I carry that process far enough, the slot eventually gets so wide that I eventually have a vertical, let me think about that carefully. Yes, I eventually end up with a twin lead where the two leads are one above the other, a vertically displaced twin lead. If I carry that far enough, I can slowly convert from coax cable to twin lead. I personally have done that, and if you do it slow enough and carefully enough, you can have an extremely broadband circuit that starts off with unbalanced 50 ohms, ends up with a beautifully balanced however many ohms you want on the twin lead, depending on the spacing between the two wires and their diameters. When you go to the appropriate chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook on the subject of balance, let me drop, you'll find out that one of the balancing structures does exactly that. It's that V-shaped curve. It's a slot cut in the outer coax cable, which allows you to convert as a balancing structure between unbalanced coax and balanced twin lead. So if the signal will flow correctly down there, I am guessing that whatever magnetic field is created inside of the outer conductor of a coax cable because of the return current, I'm guessing that magnetic field, because you're on the inside, not on the outside,